Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Reunion is a wonderful thing, it seems to me. When I was a little fellow growing up, we didn't have much entertainment like we have today. We had a radio, but we were so far from any place that had a very strong signal that we could only get the war news occasionally. And we did that through much static. But I'll tell you what we were really good at. And we weren't good at a lot of things, but we were good at visiting. And folks would come to the house and visit. And the neighbors and friends, and most of them were Christians, who came, would bring an instrument or bring something that they played or something that they had read. And we'd all exchange information of various sorts and kinds. And it was just really warm and wonderful times. There was a feeling of camaraderie. There was a kind of mutual regard for one another, a kind of respect that pervaded the whole occasion. I was just a little fellow. We had a bed in the living room because there were a lot of us. And I remember that the kids would sit on the bed and listen to the men swap yarns after we had picked and grinned a little while. And they'd all talk about things and tell stories of all various sorts and kinds. And some of them were to be believed, and some of them we understood to just be hyperbolic expressions of various kinds of events that happened. But I remember distinctly waking up the next morning just mad as I could be because I'd gone to sleep right in the middle of the visiting. And I have that same kind of warm feeling this week. I feel like that what we're doing here is kind of akin to reunion time, that we're able to be together and to share commonality and to share good things that come from the gospel and to be a participant in things that have very high and noble sorts of concepts and implications attached to them. And I'm really glad that Norma and I can be here and be a part of that. It's just a joy to have this opportunity. And I love mornings. Did you ever notice that we never speak of the evening of the resurrection? There's a reason for that, I guess. I don't know that that's significant, but I never heard anybody envision the resurrection is coming in the evening. And maybe it will. We don't know when it'll come, but there's something special about mornings, and mornings are really kind of typical of resurrection, really. It doesn't make any difference how foreboding and ominous, how portentous the nightmares are when the first rays of the sunshine cross your bed. It just basks you in optimism and you become very sanguine and ready to meet the day. And it washes away all of the fears and the dreads that come from the nightmares the night before. And so I like mornings a whole lot. I like morning services because I came to be used. And it'd be fine with me if we had one in the morning, then another one in the afternoon. It'd be all right. Because that's what I do, and I'm glad you're here today. It says something really good about you. Being a gospel preacher is not without its rewards, and I would never ask anybody to feel sorry for me about what I do, because I associate with the very finest people in the world, and I operate with the most encouragement of anybody. I feel so good about what I do that there are times in my life that I feel guilty about getting paid for being so happy in a kind of work. I never, ladies and gentlemen, hate to go to work. I never do. I don't hate anything that I do about preaching. And you just have no idea how very important that is to me, because I worked in secular work for 20 years before I was a gospel preacher. And so I know what it feels like to work all day and then come to the services at night. And I know what it feels like to help wrestle the kids and that kind of thing. But the fact of the matter is, there's some things about preaching that are hard. I didn't say I didn't like them, but they're difficult. And one of the things that is the most difficult, it seems to me, is to ascertain properly the needs of a congregation and then to address with any degree of effectivity those things in sermon material from time to time. That's really hard for me. And I suppose it to be the case that the difficulty is because I feel inadequate as regards wisdom from time to time. Wisdom is the great getting. It's the great thing that all of us need. And I freely confess to not having enough of it to choose properly all the time what needs to be prioritized and what needs to be at times left alone. And so I've made mistakes in that regard. But may I say to you that I've looked at this congregation this week. And I've tried to see, in fact, I really don't like assigned subjects for that reason. I kind of like to look and see where I think what I have in the way of little talent can help some specific situation. And I've looked around this week trying to see what I might speak on this morning that would be of some benefit. And one of the things that has impressed me about this church is the demographics. And there have been several things that have impressed me. There are lots of older folks, and that gives you wisdom and stability. There are a lot of young married people, and that gives you enthusiasm and courage. And there are lots of young people, and that gives you the kind of impetus and motive that you need to really press on. And so you have not only skilled leadership, excellent elders, a wonderful gospel preacher, and a wonderful, wonderful gospel preacher's wife, but you have all kinds of good things going for you. One of the things that I've noticed, and I don't see this as a problem area, I see it rather as an opportunity, is that you have a lot of young mothers, a lot of young married people with small children. And so I'm going to say some things to that particular section this morning. I think it might help grandpas and grandmas. And I know it'll help me as one who hopes to be a grandma or grandpa one day. My wife is not a grandmother yet. We have two marriage-age children. Neither one of them are married. And she says that Russ says that every time he comes home to Southside and Norma picks up one of the little babies at church, she gives him a dirty look. I don't know if that's so or not. But we want to do as good a job as we can when we come along to be grandparents like many of you are. So I want to talk with you this morning for a little while, and particularly is this aimed at the young mothers in the audience. I want to talk with you a little while about train up a child in the way he should go. This is a passage from Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6. And I do not assign to it, though I would not be dogmatic about this, the common sort of interpretation. It is so that amongst our brethren, most of the time, we say that this passage means if you teach a child spiritual values and you teach him good things, it is a general rule, not specific, but a general rule that when he's old, even if he goes away from those things, he will come back to them or he will not deviate from those things. That might be the case. I rather doubt it. I believe that this passage is talking about finding the natural bent of a child. I believe that what the writer is saying here is, train up a child in the way that you have determined he is bent. And when he is old, he'll not depart from it. Now, that certainly has spiritual overtones. It certainly has spiritual implications. And there are things that appertain to that, that are very, very difficult. But it is a passage that I think we need to consider carefully, particularly those of us that have children. Now, let me say in the beginning that what I believe the passage is saying then is that you find out if a child is an extrovert and you treat him accordingly. You find out if he's an introvert and you treat him accordingly. You find out what his natural proclivities are, where his natural tendencies lie. And then you address those needs specifically as a mother or a father or as parents in league with one another, and that child will go the way he ought to go. Now again, that's a general rule. That's no complete and total guarantee. But it is generally so. Now, it seems to me that rearing a child is much like teaching a child to ride a bicycle. You come home and you bought the child a new bike. And he just loves the new bike and you put the training wheels on it. And that's a chore all by itself. And then you get him on the new bike and you go down the sidewalk and the training wheels are hitting on this side and then on this side and you're trying to get the little child's equilibrium set on this bicycle and you run alongside of him and he's excited and his eyes are big and you're exciting. Both of you are breathing hard but for different reasons and he's riding and you're running and he's saying to you, Daddy, don't turn loose now. Don't turn loose, Daddy. And the first thing you know, you turn loose and he buzzes off. And the first thing you know, he tilts to one side, goes around the corner and he looks up and Daddy's not there and he becomes scared and he crashes. And he comes running back to you with tears in his streaming down his face and he says, Daddy, you turned loose. Why did you turn loose, Daddy? And he won't ride the bicycle for a little while.
And the first thing you know, little Timmy across the street is riding, and his daddy's not even home from work yet. And out goes Johnny, and on the bicycle, he says, "Come help me, Daddy. Listen, come help me ride the bike, Dad. I need to learn to ride the bike." And so you run along with him some more, and the first thing you know, he soars off down the sidewalk, and he's doing pretty well, and he's all happy about himself, until about 3 or 4 weeks later, when little Jimmy across the street comes home, and his daddy's taking the training wheels off. And here you go. You have to teach him to ride the bicycle without the training wheels. And you've known that he could do it because for 2 or 3 days now, the training wheels are not touching the ground anymore. And so you run alongside him and he says, "Daddy, don't turn loose and crash." He looks up and you're way down the block and he won't ride for 2 or 3 weeks. Then finally he gets on the bicycle one day and he says, "Daddy, come help me, but please don't turn loose." And you run along beside him and suddenly you know that you had to turn loose. And so you turn loose, and he rides off down the way, and you stand there with a chill running up and down your back and saying, "Well, there he goes, all by himself." And that's what it's like to train up a child in the way he should go. You have to watch him hurt sometimes. You have to watch him fall and get up. But you have to do the things that are necessary to help him fall the right way. And to help him get up at the right time. And to cause him to be encouraged. And to keep him from being dispirited. And to motivate him in the way that he ought to go. And that is a difficult thing. I must say to you, ladies and gentlemen, that the loss of our children in this society scares me to death. The loss of our children in the world or to the world is a major problem today. The fact is that parents everywhere are faced with the pressures that are brought upon by not only the new information age, but by the communications revolt in general. We have humanistic philosophies that are being wholesaled to our children, and they're buying those things, and the emphasis of secular humanism is seen everywhere in the world today, and as a result, children and a lot of families are turning away from God by droves. What shall we do? What can we do? Well, we can train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he'll not depart from it. We hear a lot in this day and age about child neglect. And it's one of the most repugnant things to me that I can possibly even contemplate. Who in this world would dare physically hurt a little child? Much less the most heinous and despicable of all crimes. Who would sexually molest a little child? And yet we see it with all kinds of morbidity on the news. And we see it in magazines, and it's all over. That's child abuse, and it's horrible. But the worst child abuse of all is to bring a child into the world and then not tend to his needs. And that is a very real form of child abuse. You have no right, parents, listen to me carefully. You have no right to bring a child into the world and then not train him up in the way he should go. And so I ask you this morning, what are you doing about the training up of your child? It is the responsibility of every parent. Let me say to you at the beginning that training must have a purpose. You see, a person who trains somebody in the band teaches him to act in accordance with the rules. And if he's supposed to be taking 30-inch steps while somebody else is taking 36, that's his responsibility. And when you bring a child into the world, it is your responsibility to have a purpose for that child. What is your purpose for the training up of your child? Is it to make him educated? To help him be ready to function in society? That's a noble kind of a goal, and I freely confess to it. Training must have a purpose, though, and that is a purely secular purpose. You certainly ought to do that, but there are weightier matters that appertain to the business of training up a child. There are weightier matters because you must spend some time on a child's personal spiritual education in the same way that you spend time on his personal secular education. Could I ask you something? Haven't you already started thinking about sending your child away to college and how you're going to do that? Perhaps someone has come to your home, sat down in the cool of the evening, explained to you some sort of savings program that will make it possible for you to fund your child's college education. We start thinking about that early on, and we begin to put up money. Listen to me. What are you putting up spiritually? What are you putting up that has spiritual value to it? Are you depositing anything in the young child's mind that will result in interest that is higher and much more sublimated and much better than merely physical ends or corporeal goals? Surely you must do that. Those that are after the flesh, Romans chapter 8 tells us, do mind the things of the flesh. If you want to know whether your desires and functional purposes for your child are spiritual or physical, think about what you think about them. Think about what you're planning for them. Think about your purposes. And if you're not careful, it will surprise you to find out that most of the thought time that you give to the child's future is not spiritual in its manifestation and concepts, but is rather physical. It's fine to teach him to go to college. It's fine to let him understand that he has responsibilities to function properly in society for the general welfare. But it is not fine to do that in lieu of his spiritual education. We must come to think about spiritual thoughts. Those that are in the world must not be of the world. And you must teach your children that early on. And so it's very important that you not only make him educated, but that you make him educated in the high and noble things of God. Is it your function to give him ambition and drive? Is it your function to give him those kinds of motives that he needs to go out here and be a very sagacious businessman and a handler of funds and a handler of success? Is that your thought for your child? Listen to me. How many of you have ever thought about having a child that was a gospel preacher? Have you ever in your child's life thought that you'd like to start right now to give him such a respect for elders that you would want him to grow up and be a shepherd of God's flock and teach him what a noble aspiration that is? Have you ever sat down with your child and recommended for a hero someone like your preacher here? It would be a far grander thing to help him do that than to give him the impetus that he needs to be a successful businessman. Who are your heroes? I think it's so sad that we have heroes like we have in this generation. We have heroes like the refrigerator. A huge hulking mass of a man who can hardly say his name. And yet he is a hero to the young people. That is not as it should be. The heroes ought to be those men that have great moral strength, that have great capabilities spiritually, that have desires to go to heaven. And nobody needs to know their names. You've got some of them right here among these elders, I'll tell you that. Teach your youngsters to have them for heroes and help them to be around them. And help them to imbibe of the refreshing spiritual values that these men present from time to time. When you do that, you will make your child have heroes that will cause him one day to want to be rather than some major league ball player or some great college professor or some physicist or something. You will teach him that his service to the Lord is primary. What is your aim? Is it to make him realize Christ's estimate of greatness? Ah, there is success. If you could just teach your child to value things as Jesus valued them. He said, take no thought for your life, what you shall eat or what you shall put on. God takes care of those things. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Seek, he says, first the reign of God in your hearts. Seek first the subordination of your will, and that child's will the same way, to God. Teach him to subordinate his will to God's will, and you will have trained him properly. But I'll tell you, part of the problem is that training takes discipline. You have to discipline a child, and I understand that that's the case. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is good. Honor thy father and thy mother, which is the first commandment with promise, Ephesians chapter 6 and verses 1 and 2, says that a little child must subordinate or subject himself to the discipline of parental authority. And that's just a foregone conclusion. But have you thought about the fact, ladies and gentlemen, that it takes discipline on your part just to discipline a child? You have to train yourself before you can train your child. And the problem with a lot of young parents, and part of my problems when I was a young parent, is seen in the fact that we do not train ourselves first. You have to train yourself to be what you ought to be. Then you will be qualified to chasten your son. I was preaching along these lines in Indiana not too long ago, and a lady came to me, and I was talking about whipping my kid when I was mad. I'll tell you about that maybe in a few minutes. She said my daddy was a wise man. Said he was kind of older when I came along. And she said he never whipped me when he was mad. Said he sure did chew on me when he was mad. Boy, he would vocally abuse me when he was mad. But he said he never whipped us until the next day. He said he waited and we knew at what hour we were going to get it. And he said it was just sheer misery until we got to that hour. And you know, that's just wiseness. That's just sagacity. That is good judgment. That's being equitable. That's being the kind of person who is possessed of prudence and ability to use knowledge properly. It's acumen. It's quickness of perception. And we need to develop that kind of thing. We need to be people that will chasten a son. There's a passage in Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 18 that's become very impressive to me in the last few years. He says, chasten a son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare for his crying. One of the biggest problems that you will have will be to discipline yourself to go ahead and spank him when he's crying. I knew when I was a youngster that the harder I cried, the sooner my dad would stop spanking. And I knew that. And that's what he's saying right here. And human nature has not changed in the thousands of years since that thing was written. What he's saying to you is, do not get upset with yourself because you make the child cry. It is necessary for his own training. And that takes discipline on your part. I never could understand my dad. He'd say to me, son, this hurts me worse than it hurts you. I couldn't understand that. The seat of his pants were not on fire. He was not feeling what I was feeling. And yet I have come to see that that's the case. And may I just say to you that what it is a statement of your love for the child. It is a statement of the appropriateness of parental authority. Let me say that again. It is a statement of the appropriateness of parental authority. In Proverbs 13 and verse 24, he says, he that spareth his rod hateth his son, but he that loveth him chasteneth him betimes. That's a beautiful word. It's an old English word, and it means appropriately, or it means in due time, or in just simple everyday vernacular. It says, chasten him early. It's doing it when it's called for. And we need that kind of discipline. I don't know if you'd ever thought about it or not, but a child's first relationship with any sort of kind of authority is not with God. And to some extent, however small, his respect for God in his initial formative years will be mostly based upon his respect for parental authority. And he will judge nearly all authority by what he sees in his parents. My dad used to say to me sometimes, son, do such and such. And I'd say, why, Dad, after I got up some years? And he'd say, because I told you to. That's why. And I said to myself even then, I said, when I get to be a parent, I am not going to do that. I am going to stop and I'm going to say to my children, all right, here's the reason I told you to do that. And one day I told Russ to do something, and he said, why, Dad? And I said, because I told you to, and that's enough. And it suddenly occurred to me, it was like turning a light on in my head. It suddenly occurred to me why my dad had done that. Because, ladies and gentlemen, I would not have understood if he had explained it. But here's the point. You must have enough respect for God that you do what He says, whether you understand everything about it is beside the point, because while you do not maybe understand the command, you do know implicitly and intimately Him who made the command. And God has never required anything of anybody. It was not in his best interests. And the fact of the matter is that your daddy, if he's the right kind of daddy, will not require that which is not in your best interests. And so you do it, sometimes not even understanding, but understanding the love of the commander. And that's the way that has to work. Then we should, I guess, talk for at least a few moments about the value of example. I don't think that there's any preacher who doesn't preach a lot on the value of influence or on the value of example. In fact, we've preached on that so much that I think people have kind of come to expect that. And as a result of that, there's a sort of familiarity breeds contempt idea about it. And we just heard about influence over and over and over. But you know, it's so important. Did you ever notice two old people that lived together for years and years and years? They get so they look like one another. Every time I say that, somebody punches her husband and says, "That means I'm sure glad we're looking more like me than you." But you do that. And the reason for that is that you come to emulate even idiosyncratic differences. You come to emulate personality traits. You come to emulate movements and body language and that sort of thing. And the reason for that is intimacy. And God knew that that was the case. And your child is not only genetically constructed like you are, but he's also going to be impressed with your spiritual example. And if he sees at home that you have no humility, he will not believe that humility is important. And if he sees in you no compassion, he will not be impressed with those kinds of things. If he never hears, listen to me, if he never hears his mother pray, he's likely to think that she doesn't attach much importance to prayer. You mothers need to pray with your little children. And you fathers need to pray with your mothers and little children. I go some places that I'm serious as I can be. There has not been any sort of prayer at the table. And television has done that for us. We don't have a prayer at the table because we don't eat at the table. I really believe, young parents, and you listen to me carefully, that every home ought to have at least one meal together every day where possible and without anything turned on. And that includes the radio. You ought to sit and enjoy supper time. Because supper time is a time when you can have humorous things discussed and the things of the day, and you can talk about when one and one on in school, and kids can learn to converse. There's no such thing as conversation much among kids anymore. They don't know how to visit. They don't know how to sit and analyze the day's activities and engage themselves in communicative intercourse. They don't exchange ideas because they don't know how. And that's a shame, because conversation is one of the great joys of life. We've enjoyed being with the Huttos on account of that. We've just talked and talked and talked. And we've enjoyed it so much we've missed the news every night. And I'm here to tell you that the value of the example is inestimable. And furthermore, we should spend less time, I think, telling children what to do and spend more time telling them what to be. It's fine to teach a child algebra. It's fine to teach a child geometry and calculus and science and English and literature. It's fine to teach him all kinds of things if you're teaching him love and peace and joy and long-suffering and gentleness and goodness and faith and meekness at the same time. And a lot of parents will spend hours trying to help their child understand a calculus problem, and he could not give you an adequate definition for what love is. And that's a shame. And so in the contemplation of the one, let not the other be forgotten. And you'll bring up your child in the way he ought to go. And the fact of personal responsibility is the basis for all progress needs to be taught. Let me say that again. The fact of personal accountability. You've got to teach a child that he alone is obligatory for his actions alone, not for somebody else's. He has to be taught not to blame other people. And here's where that example comes in. I'll tell you something else I'm seeing a lot is little children being critical. And the reason is all they hear is critique. The preacher is fried every day just like the chicken on Sunday. Or the fellow at the grocery store, there's nothing good about him. And they hear nothing but criticism. And what that is base selfishness. And if you exemplify that kind of thing to your children, they're going to grow up with an oblique look at life. They're going to grow up with a distorted view of what most people are. And I'll tell you what people need to understand, that there are some folks, though they're not Christians, that do some good things. And we need to understand that good is good no matter who does it. And I ought not to have to put a disclaimer on that, but I have to all the time. I'm not talking about compromising the truth. I'm just talking about how a little fella can function in society. And we can be so critical of everybody that we become pompous and bitter. And the little child becomes critical of everybody and everything because that's what he hears and sees at home. Training, as I said to you earlier, means knowing every child individually. Somebody said to me a while back, said, well, I'll tell you one thing about Junior. They threw away the mold when they made him. I want to tell you something. They threw away the mold when they made every one of them. There aren't any two of them exactly alike. And they'll have diverse personalities. My brother next to me is 18 months younger than I am. He and I went through school together. We don't look anything at all alike. He's slender and blonde. I'm dark-headed and otherwise. We went all through school together for 4 years of high school. There was 1/32nd of a point difference in our averages, and yet we're as different as night and day. I'm an extrovert and he's an introvert. But my mom and daddy knew the difference. And they tried to help, and I'll tell you what they did. They made a gospel preacher out of a guy that couldn't do it if they hadn't done it, helped him. If your child comes into the world and he's an extrovert, you're going to have to teach him humility. Anybody who's flamboyant, and I get accused of that quite a lot, is going to have trouble being humble. And I work on that. I'm here to tell you every day of my life, I pray to God about it. Because it's hard. And if he's an introvert, you're going to help him to do what he can about that. If he is a bright child, you're going to have to learn him to tolerate those that aren't bright. You'll have to teach him that just because he's bright is no commentary on anybody else. It just simply means that he has more responsibility. And you have to tell him that. If he is a shy person, you're going to have to give him confidence. You're going to have to prop him up and buoy him up and pat the backside of his britches and send him off. You're going to have to teach him how to stand up, and you're going to have to teach him how to say things, and you're going to have to teach him how to be his own person. You'll have to do that, but it's worth it, and you need to teach a child to be yourself is the best thing you can do, but you need to be the best yourself you can. And the skeptical person, you ever see those skeptical people that come into the world, and they're just full of, the curiosity is just, they're eaten up with it. And it's one question right after the other. Do you ever get tired of that? Now, don't fib to me. You ever get tired of just answering one question right after the other? Why is this, Daddy? Why did this happen? Well, what did this do? Well, how come that thing over there? And they can ask you all kinds of things. Russ came to me one time and he said, Daddy, I've been studying a Sunday school lesson about Adam and Eve. And he said, I want to ask you a question. I said, what is it? He said, do you think Adam had a belly button? Well, how do you answer that? You're gonna have to deal with that child if he is skeptical. You have to give him the time he requires, and you have to show him where to look it up, because you won't know a lot of the things he's gonna ask you. And if he's trusting, and a lot of kids are, you're gonna have to teach him to try the doctrines, to try the spirits, whether they be of God. You're gonna have to help him learn. And then, finally, could I just say to the young mothers and the young fathers, love your children. And be willing to deal with them at the various stages of life. One of the hardest things I've ever had to do was to apologize to my children about anything. One day I came in, I don't know exactly what had happened, but Russ had made me so mad, I was just visibly shaken. And I picked him up and took him back to his room, and I took off my belt and I whipped him hard, and then I just physically threw him on the bed. And I said, I want you to stay there until I tell you to get up. And I stormed out of the room and slammed the door and went down the hall, and I met Norma in the hall. What a help she's been to me. She said, honey, do you think you might have spanked him when you were mad? I reminded her who was the head of the house. And I said to her, if you've been doing what you ought to be doing, I wouldn't have to come home and spank the kids all the time. And I told her a few things. And then I got in my car, slammed the door as hard as I could, backed up and spun off down the lane, got up onto the highway, and I was driving hard and mad, and I caught a glimpse of my visage in the rearview mirror. And I said to myself, you are dead wrong. You messed up. Not only did you mess up, I remember saying this out loud. You sinned against him. I turned my car around. I went back up that lane. It was the hardest thing I've ever tried to do. I got out of the car and I went back in there and down the hall. It was a little dingy, dark down that hall. I went into his room and there he was, little old tow-headed kid, all rolled up in a knot, crying his eyes out. I went in and I picked him up and I set him on the side of the bed and I said, Russie, your daddy's a human. And I whipped you when I was mad. And I sinned against you. And I'm sorry. He said, don't cry, Daddy. It's okay. Just don't cry, Daddy. And from that day to this, no matter what kind of hard fusses we've had, it's not hard for either one of us to say, well, I was wrong about that. And as extroverted as he is, I've seen him apologize to somebody too. And that's hard. And it takes a lot of discipline. But it sure is worth it. And then finally, love your little kids, parents. Because you'll turn around about three times and they'll take the tassel and move it from this side to the other side and they'll be off to school and that'll be the end of your affair with them. Oh, they'll be back from time to time. They'll be buzzing in now. But they won't be yours anymore. They'll be theirs. And you shouldn't despair. That's what you get them ready for. But love them while you can. One of these days you'll shout, why don't you kids grow up and act your age? And they will. Or, you kids get outside now, find yourself something to do, and don't slam the door. And they will. You'll straighten up the boys' bedroom, neat and tidy, bumper stickers discarded, spread, tucked, and smooth, toys displayed on the shelves, hangers in the closets, animals caged, and you'll say out loud, now I want it to stay that way. And it will.
You'll prepare a perfect dinner with a salad that hasn't been picked to death and a cake with no finger traces in the icing, and you'll say, now there's a meal for company. And you'll eat it alone.
You'll say, I want complete privacy on the phone now. No dancing around or no pantomimes or no demolition crews. Silence, do you hear?
And you'll have it. No more plastic tablecloths stained with spaghetti. No more bedspreads to protect from damp bottoms. No more gates to stumble over at the top of the basement steps. No more clothespins under the sofa. No more playpens to arrange the room around. No more anxious nights under a vaporizer tent. No more sand on the sheets and Popeye movies in the bathroom. No more iron-on patches and wet knotted shoestrings and tight boots or rubber bands for ponytails. Imagine a lipstick with a point on it. No babysitter for New Year's Eve, washing only once a week. Seeing a steak that isn't ground, having your teeth cleaned without a baby on your lap. No PTA meetings, no carpools, no blaring radios. No one washing your hair at 11 o'clock at night. Having your own roll of transparent tape. Think about it. No more Christmas presents out of toothpicks and library paste. No more sloppy oatmeal kisses. No more tooth fairy. No more Easter bunny. No more Santa Claus. Only a voice crying. Why don't you grow up? And the silence echoing. I did. That's Irma Bombay. She says it good. Love them while you can. Care for them. Hug them close to your chest. Make their dreams real and vivid to them. Coddle their problems. Listen to their difficulties. Be sympathetic to their doubts. Buoy their spirits. Ennoble their hearts. Train up a child in the way he should go. Thank you for listening so carefully. We want to sing an invitation song in case there might be someone here who's not a Christian. We've not spoken to you, but we've spoken about the principles of truth and righteousness, and you need to obey the gospel if you haven't. If you come believing that Christ is the Son of God, willing to repent of your sins and confess your faith in Him, He'll take you home to glory when you die if you'll live right. And if you're here this morning, perhaps you owe some other duty to God. We'd be glad to help you, and nobody will look down on you. Nobody will say, what a bad person. Nobody will say that. We'll rejoice with the angels in heaven over one sinner that repented. Don't you want to do that this morning? If you do, we want to sing a song to encourage you. And won't you come while we stand and sing?